just want to start by thanking everyone again for joining us today. I hope you've enjoyed all these panels and discussions as much as I have. I want to again thank Lisa and Donna for putting together this event today. They've done a really, really great job. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Kirsten Atanasoff, and I am the president of the Madison Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. I want to remind everyone again to sign in today. If you look at your program, there's a QR code, and if you scan that, you can put in your name and indicate which events you attended today so you can get your CLE credit. I'm just here to briefly introduce our moderator today, and then I'll let her take it away. Our moderator today is Judge Shelley Grogan. Judge Grogan serves the people of Wisconsin on the District 2 Court of Appeals. Before joining the appellate court, she spent 6 years at the Wisconsin Supreme Court with Justice Rebecca Bradley, and 21 years in the District 1 Court of Appeals as a law clerk to Judge Ralph Adam Fine and Judge Ted Wiedemeyer. She also taught appellate writing and advocacy as an adjunct professor at Marquette University Law School. And she also served as a Muskego municipal judge. Something that you may not know about Judge Grogan is that she coached youth football and basketball for over a decade and officiated high school field hockey. So with that, Judge Grogan,
please. Thank you, Kirsten. So if you get out of line, you have to deal with the football coach. Stay in line here. So it's great to be here this afternoon moderating the panel. We have two attorneys and a law professor on this panel. And I'll start on the far left with the professor. Rob Yablon is an associate professor of UW Law School and faculty co-director of the law school's State Democracy Research Initiative. His research interests include election law, state and federal constitutional law, and the state and federal judiciaries. Before joining the UW Law faculty, Rob was a practicing attorney focusing on Supreme Court and appellate litigation. And before that, a law clerk on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and on the U.S. Supreme Court for Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor. Rob grew up in Wisconsin and got his undergraduate degree from UW-Madison and his law degree from Yale. In the center, we have Ryan Walsh. Ryan is a partner at Elmer Stahl and is a managing partner of the firm's Madison office. He focuses his practice on appellate and complex litigation in a wide variety of areas, including constitutional law, corporate law, labor and employment, land use, environmental, and products liability. Ryan previously served as a law clerk on the U.S. Supreme Court for the Honorable Antonin Scalia and on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit for the Honorable Diarmuid O'Scanlan. Ryan was named to Forbes 30 Under 30 Law and Policy list in 2017. He obtained his JD with high honors from the University of Chicago Law School, where he was the editor-in-chief of the Law Review and where he now serves as an adjunct professor. And directly next to me is Jeff Mandel, a partner at Stafford Rosenbaum, where he maintains a broad practice with specialties in election and political law, complex litigation and appeals, and issues related to the Wisconsin Fair Dealership Law. Jeff is also the co-founder and board president of Law Forward, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization focused on defending and advancing democracy in Wisconsin. Jeff is a graduate of the University of Chicago Law School, and before entering practice, he served as a judicial clerk for the Honorable Raymond Randolph of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. So we have quite a intelligent panel up here this morning to address the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So I'm going to ask a few questions. We'll have each panelist answer. And then when I'm done with my questions, we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So we're going to start with Professor Yablon and just kind of come down towards me with the first question. How did the recent election and the Wisconsin Supreme Court impact the judicial philosophy of the court? And do you think it's a good or a bad thing?
All right, well, first of all, thank you all for having me. It's great to be here. It's nice to see some familiar faces, including a few former students in the audience. And thanks to Judge Grogan for moderating. I I guess I'll state the obvious initially, which is that the court's composition hasn't changed yet, and we are months away from seeing decisions from a newly constituted court. And so in some ways, it's a little bit premature to say anything definitive about what we're going to see in terms of a shifting judicial philosophy on the court. I promise I won't completely dodge the question, but I'll also push back a little bit and say that I'm not totally sure that thinking about this in terms of judicial philosophy is the most helpful lens to use. During his confirmation hearing, Justice Gorsuch recounted approvingly that the late Justice Byron White used to describe his judicial philosophy as, "I decide cases." And Justice Gorsuch said, "I will give the same answer. It's a pretty good philosophy for a judge." And so, we have had 7 justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court who have been deciding cases, and we will soon have 7 justices on the Wisconsin Supreme Court who are deciding cases. So at that level, the philosophy of the Wisconsin Supreme Court is not likely to change much. And, I do want to suggest that there is something to that Justice Gorsuch, Justice White conception, which is a reminder that ultimately, at the end of the day, all judges are engaged in the same shared enterprise of interpreting and applying the law, and that we should be careful about the labels and trying to divide people into different philosophies, when in reality, judging is often a multifaceted exercise, and people are often just doing it with different points of emphasis at different times. Now, I will say that the current court has 4 justices who I think will self-identify as judicial conservatives, and soon there will only be 3 justices that identify that way. That label, judicial conservative, is sufficiently underspecified and capacious that I'm not sure that I could describe it as a philosophy. There are people who use that label to embrace a form of judicial minimalism. There are others who use that label who are much more comfortable with the court doing a lot more. There are some who use that label who insist on deference to political actors, others who express grave concerns about the excesses of the executive or legislative branches. There are people who use that label to suggest that judging should be value-free, and there are others who argue that judging actually should be animated by libertarian values or by natural law principles or what have you. Practically speaking, to be honest, I think at least when we're talking about judicial elections, that label seems most to function as a way for people to express their alignment or desire for support from political conservatives. Now, I'm not suggesting that there isn't more to it than that, but from a public perspective, that's often what that label does convey. Now, the label goes hand in hand, I think, often with people who also identify as originalists. There, too, I think that's an underspecified concept. There are many flavors of originalism. And some variants of it, I think, have near universal acceptance these days. Justice Elena Kagan has said, "We are all originalists." And so, there have been 7 originalists in some sense on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and there will continue to be 7 originalists on the Supreme Court. Again, though, the court may soon have a majority that recognizes more candidly the limits of originalism as a framework for actually resolving cases. The reality is that the original meaning of constitutional terms is frequently indeterminate. Even when words are clear, text and context might provide little real guidance to resolving specific cases. And, I suspect that we may soon have a majority on the court that is more willing to acknowledge that, more willing to acknowledge the multifaceted nature of judging, the fact that sometimes it is appropriate to think more institutionally and pragmatically about issues, rather than insisting on trying to shoehorn everything into a methodology that I think, at least on the academic side, most serious originalists will acknowledge does not provide all of the answers. Again, much remains to be seen, but I think that those might be some of the differences that we'll have to keep an eye out for on the newly constituted state Supreme Court.
Thank you. Attorney Walsh, same question.
The question often comes up in the context of the U.S. Supreme Court when ideological change occurs and a majority shifts in one direction or the other. And people ask the question, well, what will the court be like now? And in some ways, it's a funny question because the fiction or reality, depending on how you see it, is that it's one court all the way back back to the moment it was instituted. So at the U.S. Supreme Court, and I think at the state Supreme Court, at oral argument, they'll say, well, we held such and such in 1849. or we held such and such in 1963. But of course, we know the reality is that there are different judicial philosophies, and elections often turn on voters' evaluations of the judicial philosophies of the respective candidates. So I think one way it's going to, the rubber will hit, really hit the road with the Supreme Court come August, is with respect to stare decisis. Stare decisis, of course, is Latin for, you know, standing by something. And as Judge Posner often said, you don't need stare decisis for the cases that were decided wrongly, or for the cases that were decided correctly, because you're going to stand by them anyway. You're going to reach the same result. So usually stare decisis is something more than just an evaluation of whether the court previously got it right or wrong. And, you know, the reality of stare decisis debates is that it views often differ depending on who has control, right? We can't ignore the sort of realpolitik behind views towards precedent. You hear it at the U.S. Supreme Court level all the time, where the liberal minority will give the conservative majority a hard time about overruling X when they didn't, you know, when they said that overruling Y 10 years ago was a bad idea. And, you know, I guess you could see that with this court as well. Looking back on the last couple terms, in the Tavern League case, Justice Ann Walsh Bradley wrote an opinion that was sort of a paean to stare decisis in some respects. She said it's fundamental to the rule of law, and she thought she hewed to the traditional test of stare decisis in the Wisconsin Supreme Court going back decades, which is, was the prior decision unsound in principle? Was it unworkable in practice? And are reliance interests implicated? Now, there's been a debate over the past years whether it's enough just for the decision to be unsound in principle, because the job of the justice is to get it right. And it'll be interesting to see where everybody falls on that question. You know, a number of the justices have already staked out a position, which may prove difficult to get around if there's interest in overruling a particular case or not. But that'll be one thing that I'm going to be watching closely.
Thank you. Attorney Mandel.
I tend to think that both Rob and Ryan are right in a lot of ways. I'm not sure that there's a huge philosophical change. I think that justices are deciding cases. I think that, you know, is it all about originalism? Well, we all start with the text. But what do you do with it? And how do you understand it when it's indeterminate? I don't expect there to be a groundswell of change on something fundamental like stare decisis. I think that for the most part, this is another thing where most judges agree in principle. And the question is, how do you deal with it in a particular case? Over the last handful of years, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has, at several times, changed its mind about issues that have been raised in the very recent past. Is that abandoning stare decisis? Well, in each instance, there were perhaps explanations that you may or may not find compelling. And I think we'll continue to see justices grappling with those questions and those issues. But I don't think that we are, I wouldn't expect that we're likely to see, you know, sort of what we're seeing in North Carolina right now, where the court is just wholesale undoing things because of a change in personnel. I tend to think that, you know, I tend to agree with what Rob is saying, that sometimes philosophy is just overstated, or it can be easy to assume or to try to put judges, lawyers, courts into boxes, cases. The law is more complex than some of those labels. And I expect that a great deal is going to depend on how cases are presented to the court and what the facts and what the specific legal issues are.
Thank you. We'll go the reverse order, and we'll start with Attorney Mandel for this. Can you comment on the perspective you bring to the table with respect to be litigator, scholar, experience with the court? I know you've argued cases in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And anything else you'd like to share with the audience before we move on to the next two questions? So just sort of a general statement of the perspective that you bring.
I mean, I bring a practitioner's perspective to what it's like to appear in front of the court, to prepare briefs and present arguments, to do my best to answer the questions that the justices have. In the last few years, for a number of reasons, whether that some of those are procedural and the way that the court has heard so many cases on original action petitions, whether some of it is because of COVID and cases that have been heard on Zoom, there have been things that have been unusual and at times from a practitioner's standpoint, frustrating. I imagine from the other side of the bench, there are times that they're very frustrated with us as lawyers. And so, you know, I see that as sort of a continuing dynamic and an ongoing conversation between the bench and the bar. Again, I think that it is overly simplistic to try to cabin everyone and all of their work or every case into a judicial philosophy or into a political philosophy or an ideology. As someone who does a fair amount of what I think of as democracy and political work in Wisconsin, but also commercial work, you know, there are justices who deeply disagree with me on some things and agree with me on others. I think that at various times I have succeeded in winning the vote of every justice on the Wisconsin Supreme Court in something and losing the vote of every justice in the Wisconsin Supreme Court on other things, regardless of how those people might be perceived to align with me on certain ideological or political ideas.
That doesn't happen very often. 7-0 either way?
No. Sorry, none of the cases have been 7-0, but at various times, shifting allegiances.
Okay. Attorney Walsh, your kind of the perspective that you bring.
I think about as a practitioner and also as just a citizen of the state, what is the role of the state Supreme Court? And I have a few things to say about it, but I also wonder, Judge, you know, we have three people in the audience and three seats up here. We might want to just switch with certain three members of the audience. They can tell us about the future of the court and its role, but I will speculate.
All right, on three, we switch. Yeah. Ready, one, two, three.
I'll tell them what I think is my view on the role of the court and how it might change as a practitioner. So I think outsiders have two general views of a Supreme Court. And one is kind of the institutionalist view that standing behind the veil of ignorance, so to speak, how would you design a court and how should it operate, regardless of whether your people are in the majority or not, to put it crudely. And then there's sort of the partisan view, which I think a lot of people, you know, in the voting public, you know, they have that view, which is, well, what's the role of court? Tell me who's on it, and then I'll tell you what the role of the court is. On our current court, there are, generally speaking, two different views about the role of that institution. And I will attribute one to Justice Rebecca Bradley and Justice Rogensack on one side. And I will attribute the other to Justice Hagedorn. Justice Rebecca Bradley and Justice Rogensack have traditionally described the role of the court as the preeminent law declaring body of Wisconsin. And they cite old cases that say the court should exercise its original jurisdiction on cases that implicate fundamental liberties and important questions of law. They also write generally about how the lower courts have different roles. The circuit court has one role. The Court of Appeals isn't particularly like a law developing
institution. Careful.
Sorry. They sometimes are not a law developing institution.
Better,
so
much better.
It falls to the Supreme Court to say what the law is and sort of not be bashful about it. Justice Hagedorn and I would say Justice Karofsky, Justice Dalit, and Justice Ann Walsh Bradley in recent terms have hewn to a narrower, more modest approach. And I think Justice Hagedorn put it best in the Palm case. He said, it's no doubt our duty to say what the law is, but we do so by deciding cases brought by specific parties, raising specific arguments, and seeking specific relief. In a case of this magnitude, involving the safe at home order, We must be precise, carefully focusing on what amounts to the narrow, rather technical questions before us. If we abandon that charge and push past the power the people have vested in their judiciary, we are threatening the very constitutional structure and protections we have sworn to uphold. So, what happens come August? Well, you know, a cynical take might be that everybody's going to switch sides depending on who has the majority. One reason to think that that is not the case is that the current liberal wing of the court have more or less aligned with what I've characterized as the Justice Hagedorn view, just because he's authored the most opinions articulating this view. And I want to just briefly talk about where the justices have come down in three areas in particular, which have gotten a lot of attention, as Jeff mentioned. Original actions, supervisory writs, and stays pending appeal. So with respect to original actions, you know, Colin Roth, Jeff's colleague, made a great presentation last year about the history of the original action and the trends. Certainly there have been in recent years more original actions than is normal. So the standard is, are the questions of great statewide importance? Do they raise some manner of exigency? And can the court grant a speedy and authoritative determination without getting bogged down in facts? And what I've characterized as the Justice Rebecca Bradley, Justice Rogensack coalition has been more eager to exercise that power or seen it as more appropriate to do so more often, whereas the other justices have sounded some notes of caution. So does the petition depend on disputed factual claims? In the Wisconsin Voters Alliance case, Justice Hagedorn, joined by the left of center justices, said that we should be very hesitant to take on those cases. They've asked, what is the sweep of the requested relief? If it's very broad, one should tread carefully. There's also a reluctance to be the first and last stop on every seemingly important question of Wisconsin law. In Fabick versus Weck, that coalition that Justice Hagedorn wrote that the mere presence of important and unresolved legal questions does not alone merit original jurisdiction. We have an obligation to say what the law is, not shrink back from deciding challenging or politically fraught questions, but we have no institutional role to step in and answer every unsettled and interesting legal question with statewide impact. Another question that is very important to those four justices is timing. Do we really need to get involved in the dispute? And now, Justice Dallet wrote in the redistricting case, as is often the case, the question is not whether we can grant the petition, but whether we should. After the political process has an opportunity to play out, we may need to get involved, but now is not the time. In other cases, there's a lack of time to get involved. So in Hawkins, the Green Party case, Justice Hagedorn wrote that this is not the first occasion on which we have declined to exercise our original jurisdiction due to the lack of sufficient time to complete our review and award any effective relief. So, the question will be, will that view of the court's role with respect to original actions hold, or will there be a swing to the Justice Rebecca Bradley and Patience Rogensack view, on which, you know, basic question is, according to those justices, are these pure legal questions that are presented that are very important or high profile? You know, you don't take up questions about remedies and the merits. You just look at whether the questions are important and need to be decided. And as Justice Rebecca Bradley put it, we are a court of first, quoting an 1874 case, we are a court of first resort on all judicial questions affecting the sovereignty of the state, its franchises or prerogatives, and the liberties of its people. So there's a similar question with respect to supervisory writs. So for those who aren't familiar, in Wisconsin, you know, the equitable writ of prohibition and writ of mandamus have been combined into one supervisory writ. It's an extraordinary remedy that you get in you know, procedurally irregular cases or where an appeal cannot effectively happen later. And so the standard is, circuit court had a plain duty to do something and didn't do it. An appeal is inadequate remedy. There's a grave hardship or irreparable harm, and the party sought relief promptly and speedily. So there's been some discussion, although less so relative to original action cases, about how often the court should be entertaining applications for these writs, how often they should be issuing them. There's a debate about whether mere jurisdictional error on the part of the circuit court is enough to warrant a supervisory writ. Some of the justices, Justice Dallet writing, joined by Justice Hagedorn and Justice Karofsky, said, you know, we should maybe even rethink the question of whether if you end up in the wrong appellate venue under a case called DNR, which Kevin argued right in the front row here, is it enough that to argue that the Court of Appeals should have transferred venue to District 1 or District 2 or District 3 if it's District 4, is it enough to say that if that doesn't happen, it's per se irreparable harm? Well, those justices that I mentioned have suggested maybe rethinking that idea. So again, a narrower approach for the Supreme Court exercising supervisory writ jurisdiction. Finally, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues here, with respect to stays, there's a four-part standard. You have to make a strong showing that you're likely to succeed on the merits of the appeal. You have to show unless a stay is granted, you'll suffer irreparable injury. No substantial harm will come to other interested parties, and a stay will do no harm to the public interest. So there's also, likewise with stays, as with supervisory writs and original actions, there's some debate about how sweeping the court's review should be. Justice Karofsky or Justice Dallet, but one of them wrote in the Wadey case that, what was that?
You know. I'm a little Jewish ones. I'm just kidding.
No.
Read the quote.
Yeah, in Wadey, the justices wrote, I disagree with the majority's novel application of the law regarding stays pending appeal. It reduces what has traditionally been a four-factor balancing test to two questions. Is it de novo review, and should the court issue a stay? Basically, did the court get it right or wrong? And the important part of the quote is, in doing so, the majority undermines circuit court's discretion whether the equities of each case demand a stay be issued or not.
You so want to take credit for that, Justice Karofsky? Okay.
Okay. So I think in each of these areas, sort of in the Supreme Court's shadow docket, you might say, which is the term used for SCOTUS, when the court is dealing with things other than just the ordinary petitions for review, which perhaps will be a change in approach to those as well, but it'll be interesting to see whether there's movement there. I guess a lot will depend on Justice Protasiewicz and her views on those issues.
Thank you. Professor Yaban, you want to talk about the perspective you bring? And then I think Attorney Walsh merged us right into the anticipated role of the court in shaping public policy.
Sure. Well, so I'll be very brief in terms of perspective. I did practice for a few years at a large national law firm doing Supreme Court and appellate work. So, you know, I've been there in the trenches representing clients. And I think as an academic, the luxury that I have is to be able to zoom out a little bit, and the perspective that I offer is someone who can think without the constraints of someone who has to represent a particular client in a particular case. And so, you know, I'm able to think sometimes across different contexts, across different courts, comparing things that are happening in Wisconsin, say, to other states, or comparing what happens at the state level to what happens in the federal system. I mean, I don't know that I have much more to offer in terms of just background perspective, but did you want to get into the next question?
Sure. I think Attorney Walsh went into the next question about the anticipated role of the court in shaping public policy in particular areas going forward compared to how it was in the past. What legal trends might this court join or depart from? If you want to go ahead and give your thoughts on that, and we'll come back to Attorney Mandel on that question.
Sure. Well,
I messed up the order. I'm sorry.
No problem.
It's a free for all now.
I'll be brief on that as well. I mean, I thought that was very interesting and appreciated hearing that these are kind of big, interesting, uncertain questions to some extent going forward. And I think it to some extent reinforces what I was suggesting in the beginning, which is that there's a lot that happens at the court that doesn't really turn on things like ideology or left-right divisions. You know, what is the liberal approach to original actions or to supervisory writs, or you know, what is the liberal or conservative approach to stare decisis? I mean, I think these are those that fall into that category of interesting questions where you have people who might be identified or self-identify as being in one ideological bucket or the other, but that actually the Venn diagrams often come and overlap in interesting ways on some of these things. And so I thought that those are all good examples to highlight. I mean, you know, there are obviously big substantive areas of law that are likely to get litigated in the near future. I don't know to what extent I'll need to get in that now. Maybe there'll be Q&A and people can press us more on those. I mean, I think the one thing to look out for now in terms of the court's anticipated role is that we have been in a position for a long time where it seems that there has been a majority on the court that has tended to be quite deferential to the legislative branch. And often less deferential to the executive branch. And I do wonder if we are going to see at least some shift in the relative levels of deference to which those branches are owed, and maybe we'll see new arguments about why it is that one or the other of those branches is entitled to more or less deference. You know, in favor of legislative deference, you know, we often hear that lawmakers are closest to the people, that this is the branch that the founders meant to be the most accountable branch. But, you know, as a practical matter, is that analysis that really holds up, say, in a time of gerrymandering? And similarly, there's often skepticism expressed about unelected bureaucrats, and is that something that the framers had in mind? But to the extent that those individuals really are accountable directly to elected officials, to the extent that their actions can be overridden by elected officials, how skeptical do we really need to be about their attempts to regulate? And so I think that I'm looking forward actually to seeing some of the arguments and perspectives on those issues as the court shifts.
Attorney Mandel, did you want to comment on
the
anticipated role?
Let me pick up on that end piece, because I think there is room. Some of those questions are super interesting. I mean, I think Justice Bradley and I agree. There's this long-standing line of cases the Wisconsin Supreme Court has said for decades, we defer and assume that anything the legislature does is constitutional, and you have to show beyond a reasonable doubt that it's unconstitutional. I believe there was an opinion several years ago, Justice Bradley, where you said this doesn't make any sense. What does this really mean? And I couldn't agree more. And then you look at it in the context, and I think this is part of what Rob's hinting at, of something like Tetra Tech, where the court is cutting down on deference to the executive branch, or even, I mean, you could look at the COVID cases, at Palm and at Fabic, and say, the court is giving very little deference to the executive. Why should the legislature get the benefit of the doubt, especially when what's happening in those legislative debates is frequently if someone stands up in the legislature and says, I oppose this bill because I think it's unconstitutional, a frequent answer to that is, oh, the courts will figure it out. That's not a good reason to vote against it. But then you get to the courts, and the courts say, oh, well, the legislature passed it, so we're going to give them the benefit of the doubt. And I believe, actually, that it was your analogy that it becomes the fly ball that falls between all the infielders while they point at each other and blame each other. The other thing I'd just like to say, going back to what Ryan had to say, is it feels to me like Ryan wants it both ways. Right? He starts with stare decisis. He says, all these things that Misha and Luke and others in this room, Kevin have, and I being Ryan, have won in the last few years, that's all locked down because all of these, you know, Justice Bradley says that stare decisis is really important. And I agree, stare decisis is really important. And I think that decisions that a majority of the court has signed on to matter. But then he says, but those same justices, they need to stick with their own positions on all of these procedural issues, where every single piece that he quoted, with the exception of Hawkins, and he attributed Hawkins to Justice Hagedorn, and unless there's something that you know that I don't, I mean, that was per curiam opinion.
I got mixed.
Unless you were quoting a concurrence,
maybe
all of the things that you're quoting, whether it's Justice Karofsky or Justice Dalit or Justice Bradley or Justice Hagedorn, those were either concurrences or dissents. And so those are not the judgments of the court. The judgments of the court in those were orders that, notwithstanding those positions, the court was going to go forward and hear those things, with the exception of the Wisconsin Voters Alliance, where the court did decline, or also Fabic versus Evers, Favick versus Weck, where the court did decline to take those as original actions. But again, what you're quoting is not the opinion of the court. You're quoting a one justice concurrence. So to say that those are somehow binding, you know, to say those are binding, everybody has to follow that. And also stare decisis matters. There's a tremendous tension there. And I think that it's, again, I'm more with Rob on this. I think there's a lot of complexity, and I think we're going to see it play out on a case-by-case basis. But I do think you can't expect pure fidelity on both sides from your answer to the first question, your answer to the second.
Attorney Walsh, would you like to respond?
Sure.
Defend yourself.
Jeff. I love you, Jeff. I don't think I said that. So, first of all, I love all the justices very much.
That's part of the practitioner viewpoint that we bring that Rob doesn't have to worry about.
No, I love them all.
I am here solely as a practitioner. I am a mercenary. I have no personal views. And also, I have obtained the vote of every justice. I have won unanimous cases, unlike you, Jeff.
Indeed.
But no, I don't think anybody's bound by anything. Even with with judicial philosophy, I don't know how you could bind a future justice about what the fundamental oath of office is that he or she takes. Stare decisis. I mean, is there stare decisis effect of stare decisis opinions? That I would go to the professor because that makes my head hurt. No, but I just think it's what's interesting is that in separate opinions, justices will make comments about the role of the court because I've clerked. I've never been a judge, but I noticed from my time clerking that when you have separate opinions and dissents and majority opinions, sometimes there's like almost an advocacy spirit that. That descends upon the judges. And so sometimes you say things about, courts overstepping, we should have never taken this original action, or, the stare decisis is way more important than the majority is saying. And, obviously future litigants are going to take those words seriously, as I think everybody in Wisconsin should. I've always been a formalist. I'm not a realist. I think the words that the justices write matter. I don't think they're lying. I think they believe what they're writing. So you can distinguish it as you have ably done as a University of Chicago Law School graduate, but I still think it's very important to take their word seriously. You have to arbitrate this.
No.
We'll move on. So in the recent election for Supreme Court, we saw a transition from what traditionally was a comparison of the candidates' judicial philosophy, legal experience, and endorsements to actually publicly expressing personal values, combined with an advertising campaign explicitly stating the candidate supports abortion rights. Is this a positive or a negative for the judicial branch in Wisconsin? And we will start with
Jeff.
Great. So I've never run a campaign. I've never been on a ballot. I relate to Justice Bradley saying earlier that was something she didn't really see herself doing or envision that she would want to do. I've also never worked as a political professional, trying to be in a campaign or lead a campaign. So I don't really know what exactly works. I do find, I think not surprisingly, given what I've already said about judicial philosophy, I find some of the hand-wringing about all of this to be a little bit odd. I don't think that judicial philosophy is, Ryan just said it's not binding. And I think that if those of us in this room have a hard time being really certain what those judicial philosophies mean, how are members of the public supposed to understand a campaign if all it says is, well, I'm an originalist or I'm not, or I'm a textualist or I'm not, or that person's not as much of this as I am. I don't think that that's particularly meaningful. I also don't think a contest that is, you know, I got X hundred numbers of endorsements and my opponent got fewer, is particularly illuminating either. If that is the way that we think these things should be decided, then we really shouldn't be electing our judges. We should be appointing them through some kind of merit selection system by a group of insiders, and there are a million ways to do that, that can be designed to get at whatever it is that you want. We have chosen in Wisconsin, for better or for worse, since the founding of the state, that we elect our judges and our justices through popular elections. There are judicial canons of ethics that make clear that there are certain things that sitting judges and even aspiring judges don't say, or when they do, if they cross those lines, that there are certain consequences that come with that. And I think that everything short of that is fair game. I understand that there are people who are unhappy to hear judicial candidates say, here are my personal values, here's what I believe. But again, I have a hard time getting exercised about this. It wasn't that long ago that Justice Prosser sat on our court, and I was not here, and I don't know what Justice Prosser's judicial campaign was like. But I do know that he was Speaker of the Assembly before he was on the court. There's no doubt that most people in Wisconsin had ready access to what he believed about almost every popular issue and partisan issue and controversial issue of the day. I don't think that means that he shouldn't be able to serve. I don't think it means that he couldn't be or wasn't a good justice. I don't think it means that his campaign should be limited. But if we were to say, well, judicial candidates shouldn't talk about certain things, how is it fair for someone who's running against Justice Prosser when they don't have this deep record? We allow all kinds of people to run for these offices, and as long as they stay within those judicial ethical canons, I think the rest of this is kind of a distraction.
Let's skip the middle and go down to the professor to answer first, and then we'll end with Ryan.
Sure. So, first big picture, I would suggest that, you know, what we saw in the election here in April was in some ways the culmination of trends that we've seen around the country for two decades or more now, with judicial elections becoming more ideologically polarized, becoming more expensive. And so, this election wasn't different in kind, but the volume was turned up in ways that it hadn't quite been before. Why are judicial elections like this now? Well, legally speaking, the U.S. Supreme Court helped pave the way for this in at least two ways. One is its 2002 decision in Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, where Justice Scalia held that judicial candidates, have a First Amendment right to announce their views on disputed legal and political issues. And so in that case, they overturned a Minnesota judicial ethics rule that limited what candidates could say on the campaign trail. And, you know, I have mixed feelings about that ruling, but once that door is open, it's no surprise that candidates do say more and more. I mean, Justice Scalia noted in that opinion that, quote, philosophical generalities have little meaningful content for the electorate unless they're actually exemplified by more specific criticisms, for example. In that case, one of the judges wanted to speak out about what he saw as some of the Minnesota Supreme Court's rulings that, in his view, were too soft on crime or too pro-abortion. And Justice Scalia said that was acceptable. And then you layer that, the recognition that there is this First Amendment right at stake, layer that with the court's permissive view when it comes to campaign finance and the fact that there are more and more ways without regulation for candidates not only to raise money for themselves. In fact, there are still some limits on that, but for outside groups to come in and, hijack maybe is too strong a word, but to take over the messaging for races in ways that are independent of what candidates might want to say. And when that's happening out there, it would be almost a little bit more strange and unfair to say that the candidates themselves couldn't have their own voice heard and to say what's being falsely represented or misrepresented about them. And so, you know, that I think like is at least a partial explanation of why we ended up where we did. I don't think it's the first best world. I don't know what the first best world would look like. But I'm not uniquely troubled by the statements that, you know, you identified or the discussion about values in this race. I mean, that is ubiquitous out there. There are a number of states across the country that have partisan elections where their judges are literally running on the ballot as Democrats or Republicans. And then, you know, as in North Carolina, immediately coming in and reversing the judgments that, you know, the Democratic majority court had just issued. I'm glad that we have nonpartisan elections, and at least there's a norm in Wisconsin that judging is supposed to be distinctive and judges are supposed to have a distinctive role. But, you know, that is a model of adjudication that's out there across the country. You know, appointed systems of appointment don't completely get around this. If you just think about the public's faith in the federal judiciary, it's taken some hits in recent years. And, you know, you could identify a number of reasons for that. But there are plenty of people that have their suspicions about, you know, the fairness of, say, justices who were appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court by a president who promised that he would appoint judges who are pro-life and who he expected would overturn Roe versus Wade. And, you know, and then they do. And again, I really don't mean to impugn the integrity or reasoning of those judges. But I don't see that as different in kind from the concerns that some people might have about statements that are made by in this campaign. And if you accept that those justices on the U.S. Supreme Court are able to put their personal views aside and act in good faith, then, you know, you probably ought to give the same benefit of the doubt to other folks as well.
Do you think, Professor Yablon, that on the justices that have to go through the confirmation hearings, that they should talk about their values and where they are on different social issues then, and that should not affect whether or not they're confirmed or not confirmed?
Yeah, I mean, the confirmation, I almost hate to go down that road, because the federal confirmation hearings are a mess, and they're frustrating for everyone. And I don't know what the right answer is there. I think that, you know, there is maybe something to be said for more candor rather than less, because otherwise you just have folks out there that are cynical and feel like people are being unforthcoming and disingenuous. And so at least if people are being more forthcoming about things, we don't have that objection that can be raised anymore.
But you would have the objection that judges are supposed to decide cases based solely on the law, not on their personal values. And you'd have the objection that the judicial branch are supposed to be neutral arbiters and not legislators. I mean, this whole Federalist Society organization is based upon the principle that judges should decide cases on the law and not legislate from the bench.
Oh, I mean, I think that's, yes, completely agree with that. I mean, but, you know, again, here's some of the things that Justice Scalia said in that Republican Party in Minnesota versus White case. He said that he recognized the reality that most judges do have, quote, preconceived views on legal issues. He quoted Chief Justice Rehnquist, who said, quote, proof that a justice's mind at the time he joined the court was a complete tabula rasa in the area of constitutional adjudication would be evidence of lack of qualification, not lack of bias. And so, you know, people come to the court with views, and I do think that we do have to have some faith, and hopefully faith for people of different perspectives, that they will put that aside. They'll recognize that when they put on the robe, there is a distinctive role that they're playing. And they'll make, you know, judgments according to law.
That is what the robe is for. Attorney Walsh, do you want to comment on the question?
Sure.
Do you need the question again? Or?
No, just briefly. I marvel at people who win judicial elections, and especially statewide judicial elections. So congratulations to the three of you. I don't know how you do it. I mean, the whole thing is premised on the idea that the people of Wisconsin, which is, you know, part of a constitutional republic, and one of the virtues of a constitutional republic is normal people don't have to think too much about what people in government are doing. They can go along, they can go on with their lives and attend to their business. But then they're called upon, you know, in this judicial election to think very deeply about things that we think about every day because of our jobs. And so I think, you know, I think both sides have a tremendous challenge in every judicial race
and especially in races for the Supreme Court, to really connect with voters about judicial philosophy. Because yeah, keeping it abstract, talking at a high level of generality, I mean, that it's difficult to persuade anyone when you're doing that. So you do have to talk details. You do have to be specific, because otherwise no one's gonna understand, you know, what is rule of law? What is original meaning? What, you know, that's stuff normal people don't have to think about, you know, God bless them. So I think the real challenge in a system where there are judicial elections is candidates have to rise to the occasion and connect with the voters about why their judicial philosophy, his or her judicial philosophy, is the correct one, and why that person should be elected instead of the other person. So, you know, let the best one win. So I think that's, you know, I think that is the challenge, and I don't know, I don't know how I would do it, and I don't know how you all did it, but that certainly requires a kind of prudence, especially because, as Jeff mentioned, you know, these are lawyers who have ethical obligations as officers of the court or as sitting judges, so you also have to walk that tightrope carefully. But it seems to me there's always going to be a challenge in persuading people who don't think much about FedSoc stuff that they should vote for you or vote for the other person.
Well, I had the unique perspective, as you heard from my biography, of working in the appellate courts for a very long period of time. And back in the late 1990s, when Ralph Adam Fine, who was politically a Republican, and Ted Wiedemeyer, who is politically a Democrat, both of which I served as their law clerks at various times, they ran against each other for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And there was no politicization that we saw in this election and that we've seen in recent years. And I'm going to quote Judge O'Scanlan, who spoke recently, who you clerked with, Ryan, said that the politicization is a cancer that strikes at the politicization of the judicial elections is a cancer that strikes at the very heart of the American ideal of self-governance. And it's shifting judges who are supposed to be deciding cases based on legal reasoning, the text, and supporting the Constitution, to deciding political and social issues. And it may be the downfall of the judiciary. So it's troubling to me. But the people of Wisconsin have chosen their justice. And so we will see if the black robe can truly put aside the values and the personal positions that were expressed as we go forward on August 1st. But would any of you like to comment on that?
I guess I would just say, you know, I would pick up on what Rob said, that this was not unique to this election. This is the culmination to date. I have no doubt that trends will continue absent something that will change, some change in circumstance that will cause them to change. But this is the culmination of where we've been headed for a long time. I will also say, you know, Ryan talks about how difficult, and I think he's right, it has to be to go out and speak to people and try to talk about why you should be voted for, and you know as well, you've done this as well. Why should someone vote for you and not for another? I have no idea. Again, I'm not a political professional, I'm not a campaign consultant, I'm not a pollster. I have no idea what accounts for the exact results in our most recent election or any of the ones before that. But what I can tell you is, as someone who does think a lot about these issues, you know, when Justice Kelly says, and he came to my law firm and spoke, and he and I spoke about this directly afterwards, when he says, I know that I'm not partisan, and this is I think a fairly routine way that he campaigned and explained, I know I'm not partisan because I lay out all the logic, and it's an unbroken chain, and it's the only way to get from A to B, and therefore there can't be any politics in it. Personally, I just don't find it compelling or believable that when we have cases of the kind of complexity and issues of the kind of complexity we have, that there's only one way to get from A to B. I just don't believe that. I think that he may believe that B is the only outcome, but And we see it with concurring opinions and things. There are different paths and different ways to get there. And I asked him about that, and he just flatly told me that was false.
I agree with him.
I was gonna say, so we disagree about this, yep. and I probably disagree with many of you in this room about this, but you know, one possibility, probably not a popular one in this room, but one possibility is that there are people in Wisconsin who just say, that doesn't make sense to me. I don't buy it.
Yeah, I mean, we're getting to very fundamental questions here. I've heard that Judge Sutton, Chief Judge Sutton on the Sixth Circuit in law clerk interviews will ask candidates, in a given case, is there a right answer and a wrong answer? And he wants them to say, yes, there is a right answer and a wrong answer. You know, given first principles, given, you know, unlimited research, which you often don't have the time to do that, you can find the right answer. And because it exists. And you know, that's sort of a more judicial formalist model, which, you know, I'm not gonna put words in your mouth, Jeff, you might be kind of resisting that idea. But that all that to say, I mean, that really gets down to the core of debates about the judicial role. I mean, are you really just looking for an answer and solving a math problem? Or does it matter? What your background is, what your personal views are, that comes up with every confirmation at the Supreme Court level. So, big question.
Professor, did you want to make any further comment?
I don't have much to add to that. I mean, I probably, when we think through a really hard legal problem and we reach a conclusion, then we all think we've gotten the right answer. But, you know, some of the time, at least, we're coming to different answers. And so we can't all be right about that, no matter how hard we're trying. And so, you know, I may reach a different conclusion on something from time to time from Ryan, but I guess at that point, I just need to be modest enough to realize, well, are there really, I think this maybe goes in some toward what Jeff was saying. Is there really then truly only one right answer to that question? Maybe there is. Or maybe we're both getting it wrong in some way.
Well, I worked with Judge Ralph Adam Fine, and there was always a right answer. It was Occam's razor. It was very easy to write cases when I was working with him. And if we're struggling to find the right answer in analyzing a statute, I think we should just blame the legislature. With that, I will open it up to questions from the audience. Judge Ruse.
Yes, I find the discussion of ontological skepticism very interesting on these matters, but could you tell me what your expectations are, or maybe what your hopes would be? This is a little more nuts and bolts in terms of opinion writing, what you, from your perspective, you as, you know, good things, bad things, so that we would want more of, less of, in reading opinions from our appellate courts.
I'll start. Here's something I hope we'll see more of. I hope we'll see fewer fractured opinions. I hope we'll see more majority opinions from the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I also hope that when the court needs to fracture, that it is clearer about exactly what the law is and what has majority support and doesn't. I've been thinking about this a lot. We've had a number of cases over the past decade, and here too, we're talking about trends. These things are pretty clearly just going up. Where the court fractures, and let me just quickly define what I mean. I mean that we don't have a clear majority of four for both a outcome and a rationale. Many of us learned in law school that when the U.S. Supreme Court has these fractured opinions and you get these crazy syllabi that say, you know, these three justices agree with section 1A2 but don't agree about this footnote, and that what we do is we look for the narrowest grounds of agreement between the majority pieces and the concurrent opinions. That's not true in Wisconsin. Wisconsin law is actually exceptionally clear, going back more than a century, that we follow a rationale rule. If there aren't four votes, not just for the outcome, not just for the mandate, but four votes for why we got there, we don't have a holding. We've resolved the dispute between the parties in front of us, but we haven't changed the law. And that is, with great respect and full knowledge that, you know, I sit on this side of the table and I've never had to sit on the other side of the table and go to conference with my colleagues and try to work this out. From a practitioner's standpoint, and I think largely from the public standpoint, it's not very helpful. It doesn't get us anywhere, and it doesn't advance the ball. Now, there might be times where we say, well, maybe it is helpful. Maybe these questions are so hard. Maybe there's real value and modesty in not making long-term changes here. And I can appreciate that, but then what I would hope the court does is be much more transparent and much clearer about what's happening and what is and isn't the law coming out of those cases. So that's one thing I'm very much hoping we'll see. And I don't think that that's I don't think that maps along ideological lines or partisan lines or anything like that. I think that there's you can go back and look over the last 10 years and see cases with all different combinations of justices that are a little bit confusing about this. But one thing that has happened in the past few years is more cases that look a little bit more like the U.S. Supreme Court, where instead of saying, here's a narrow, frequently per curiam opinion that tells you what the outcome is here, and then everybody else is going to write in concurrence or dissent, we're seeing more opinions that say, well, this number of people agree with these paragraphs, and but not these paragraphs. And it's very, very confusing, and it's difficult. Tetra Tech is a perfect example. It was one of these opinions. The lead opinion, as we call them here in Wisconsin when they don't have four votes all the way through, was, I haven't looked in a while, I think it was about 108 or 110 paragraphs long. Only about 40% of that had force of law. Only 40% of those paragraphs had the votes of four justices. And a few years ago, about a year and a half after the opinion came down, Misha and I were on a panel for the state bar talking about Tetra Tech and what it looked like in practice. And I looked up every circuit court decision that had cited Tetra Tech to date. And there was one judge in the state who had correctly cited only paragraphs that were the law. Every other circuit court judge who had cited Tetra Tech had cited things that were concurrences. They were not, they didn't have the force of law. They were not actual statements of law according to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I don't fully fault the circuit judges. It happens, lawyers make these mistakes, judges make these mistakes, and the court is in the best position, as they would have taught us at the University of Chicago, it's the least cost avoider, to solve this and to make it clearer.
Do you have any suggestions for the Court of Appeals? Because we don't do any of that. And Judge Ruse is on the Court of Appeals as well, and he asked the question. So
I will say, I promised Justice Kelly that I would say this, and I have said it to every one of your colleagues and Judge Ruse's colleagues who I've had the privilege to encounter over the last few months. I think the Court of Appeals should hear more arguments. I think that it would be good for the Court of Appeals. I think it helps clarify issues and cases. I think it would be good for the bar and good for the Supreme Court. They would see better briefs and hear better arguments if people had the chance to go through the refinement of having to answer questions from judges, of having to figure out what works and what doesn't. And if lawyers had more practice presenting oral arguments, the quality of the oral argument overall in front of the Supreme Court would rise. More people would be like Ryan, and fewer people would not. So people like
my
me.
Guy.
So that's one thing I would love to see from the Court of Appeals. I know District 4 recently heard an argument. I know Judge Lazar and I recently had this conversation at a Federalist Society event, and she promised me that District 2.
District 2 just had an oral argument, and we have another one scheduled.
Exactly. But since you asked specifically about the Court of Appeals, I will tell you, I promised Justice Kelly, and I will continue to meet that promise, that every time I see a Court of Appeals judge, if they ask my opinion, I will say, you should hear more arguments.
So lawyers that have cases in the Court of Appeals ask for oral argument. Judge Lazar and I will usually grant it if we're on the same panel.
So you read that part of the brief
at the very top?
I was thinking, are they reading this?
We read it. We decide cases in panels of three. So for a while, I was the only one who wanted oral arguments. Now I have Judge Lazar with me. She also likes oral arguments. So we're actually considering doing a justice on wheels type of oral argument where we travel to the county that the case originated in and do our oral arguments there. So ask us for oral arguments. You may receive a yes to that. So, Attorney Walsh, with respect to Judge Ruse's question, what would you like to see in opinions?
I think, Justice Hagedorn has written about petitions to bypass, and there might be differences of views on when in whether to grant a petition to bypass, basically leapfrog the Court of Appeals, for those of you who don't know. And I know Justice Hagedorn has said, I want the input of the Court of Appeals. One of the values of a Court of Appeals is to get three really smart people who know a lot about the law, who do this for a living, to give their views. So I guess my advice would be, write more like, you know, your opinion really matters. Write like you're a Supreme Court justice. I mean,
have you read my opinions?
Yeah. I'm just giving general advice.
And publish more of your opinion. Not the Court of Appeals could publish more of its opinions.
We're working on that.
I think the Supreme Court wants your views, and whether that means you have to write a concurrence because you're bound by precedent, so be it. But I think you can also express, you know, your views of what the law, you know, whether there's a good case for overruling precedent or whatever. I wouldn't be shy about that.
I'm not shy about that. I've done that. Professor Yablon, do you have any suggestions on opinions?
I mean, I'll mostly leave that one to the practitioners, although this point did remind me. I will mention, it would be great for those of you who are in a position to do something about this, to make litigation documents and decisions, even unpublished ones, more accessible, including online. You know, for those of us who are interested in these things but are not parties to cases, sometimes it can just be hard to get the documents you need to figure out what's going on.
We're working on it.
Yes, I was going to say, that goes to the justices. Any other questions for the panel? Yet? You can just talk loud if you have a football voice.
So this follows up on the discussion about deference to political witness. I think it's fair to assume in the next coming months we'll have arguments in Wisconsin about operationalizing the Wisconsin Constitution to protect certain individual rights. My question relates to implementing doctrines. So the US Supreme Court, I think some people have observed that there may be a move away from tiers of scrutiny to things like history and condition tests. The Georgia Supreme Court, for instance, is currently hearing a case to determine whether or not the rational basis test really exists there. What do you think might happen in Wisconsin when we get these cases under the Wisconsin Constitution? Setting aside the particular rights at issue, the particular subject matter, what do you think might happen to implement?
Good question. Who'd like to answer that?
You want to take the multi-state approach?
I mean, we saw Bruin come out of the United States Supreme Court, which eliminated the scrutiny test with respect to the Second Amendment. I assume that's maybe what you're referring to, at least.
That's part of the sort of framing of the question. Mm-hmm.
I guess I'll take an initial crack at it in two ways. First, I'll say I do have some sympathy for the justices, who I think includes the Chief Justice of the United States, who's not a fan of the rigid tiers of scrutiny, which have a certain amount of artificiality to them. And whatever tier of scrutiny you're applying, really, what are you doing? You're making an assessment of the extent of the burden on a right, and you're making a judgment about whether there is a good enough state interest that is well enough tailored to justify the burden that's being imposed. And so, I think you can do that without trying to put it into either rational basis or intermediate or strict scrutiny. And so maybe we'll see more of a shift along those lines. The second thing that I guess I would say is I am skeptical that if what you were hoping for is to give the lower courts more guidance and reach more consistent results, that the way to do that is through the kind of, say, history and tradition approach that you're getting in Bruin, which I think is driving lower court judges nuts right now and leaves a lot of uncertainty, right? These are brand new doctrines that are being fleshed out, and we're going to see circuit splits and all the rest. So I would not so much encourage us in this state to go down that road.
Anyone else? Otherwise, we'll try and get one more question.
I'll just very quickly say that, like Ryan, I have great respect for all the justices, and so I'm not going to presume to try to say what the right answer is, but I do want to flag that I think there's a lot of room in Wisconsin for the court to think about these issues. Because what we mostly see is across time is a lot of cases that say we're going to sort of presume that a lot of these provisions of the Wisconsin Constitution are coextensive with the federal Constitution, and we sort of follow federal law. But the court has been very consistently careful to say we presume. So there is space for the court to say, you know what, we've never really thought about this, and we might think about it differently. And so to the extent that there's interest in approaching some of these questions in new ways or in different ways, or trying to course correct for some of the shortcomings of doctrine that the U.S. Supreme Court has evolved over time. I think that there is room in Wisconsin for that kind of creativity.
One more question?
Sure. I do have a loud voice, but I'm going to use the microphone.
I don't even know if that microphone is on, to be honest with you.
So this goes back to something that we talked about early on. It was also kind of a discussion that was had with regard to a potential swing of deference towards the executive versus the legislative that was talked about by the panel early on. And in discussing that, I'm wondering if the panel views comparing that swing even-handedly is the right way to look at it, given that we're talking about deference to the legislative branch versus, in many cases, deference to kind of the fourth branch of government, this administrative state that has increasingly co-opted large amounts of power, some of it ceded by the legislature. But is comparing those kinds of swings the right way to look at it when we have this kind of fourth branch that maybe wasn't contemplated by drafters of the Constitution?
Really, really great question. You must be a Lococo.
Yes.
Who would like to answer
They're
that?
Everywhere. I feel like that goes a little bit back to some of the, there's a lot of depth to that question, right? We're back to some of the ontological disputes. But I think that we should break it down more. That kind of deference, deference to the executive is more appropriate at higher levels of the executive. You know, a secretary who has been appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate perhaps is entitled to more deference than somebody in a small office at DNR that most people don't know exists. But I also think that the question itself has an important qualifier in it, which is frequently this is ground that has been ceded by the legislature. So when the legislature expressly delegates that an agency should do something, that leads, and the more specialized knowledge and expertise, the stronger case I would think there is for delegation. But I think it's an interesting question, and it's not obvious to me that the answer here is to swing back to more deference to the executive. Maybe the answer is just to hold the legislature to the same standards that the executive has been held to. You know, Ryan talked about stays earlier. My read of the Wisconsin Supreme Court stay jurisprudence over the last several years, for a while it was hard to find because a lot of it was issued in orders that weren't publicly available. You know, but if you go back to the cases from the 2018 extraordinary session, to the League of Women Voters case, the SEIU case, and then you look at the Wadey case where some of this was published, my view of this is essentially the court has said, if there is a challenge to the constitutionality of a statute, and a circuit court decides that the statute is unconstitutional, and enjoins it, that injunction must immediately be stayed. Because there is, and I'm forgetting the exact word, a harm of the first order, first magnitude. I'm looking at Misha because we litigated a bunch of these, right? A harm of the first order to the people of Wisconsin if the laws that the legislature passed aren't applied. Respectfully, I have no idea what that means. I mean, there's a harm of the first order to the people of Wisconsin if their constitutional liberties are being abused by the legislature. And if the answer is there's such a thumb on the scale that the legislature gets special treatment and always gets the stay, then essentially circuit courts no longer have the power of injunction, which is a constitutional prerogative. I just don't understand where that is. So, you know, I think that there's room on both sides. We could lighten up the deference to the legislature. Maybe we give a little bit more deference back to there might be a happy medium somewhere, but I don't agree if the premise is the only way to do this is to give all the deference back to the executive. I'm not sure that that's the right answer.
Jeff made a point earlier about it not making sense to afford a presumption of constitutionality to legislators because they often push the limits and even kick the question of constitutionality to the courts in the first place. I would think that same logic would apply to agencies. I think a lot of agencies do that. They say, well, we'll see how this regulation fares, and
you know, we'll see if we can get away with it, or we'll see, you know. And so I think, you know, ultimately on questions of deference, I've always thought of deference as more of like a multi-factor test or a balancing test rather than like a rigid rules approach. Like, why would you as a court bind yourself to the mast before the case is even before you and force yourself to defer in this situation, not defer in this situation? No, we want judges to exercise judgment. And if that means deferring to an agency's subject matter expertise because the legal question turns on a bunch of technical facts, well, you know, have the intellectual humility to take seriously the agency's argument because of their subject matter expertise. But, you know, if the question is, how does this interpretive canon interact with this interpretive canon? Well, I'm not expecting the subject matter, you know, IP experts over at the Patent Protection Board to have expertise in how to reconcile the two interpretive canons. So I think if you think about it like that, I have no idea if I'm even answering the question, is the, you know, makes a lot of sense. And I think the court has taken that approach.
So I guess I'll just add, first of all, you know, the delegations are made and delegations can be taken away when an agency overreaches. And so, you know, I think a lot of this can be dealt with through the political process. I would say that, you know, concerns about excessive delegation or overreach by executive actors, unelected executive actors, is rooted on this idea, well, that really governing should happen through our elected legislators, because that's where the accountability is. And I think if that's your rationale for wanting to limit delegation and wanting to keep power in the hands of the legislature, because the legislature is the true representative of the people of Wisconsin, then I think you at least have to ask yourselves whether, if that's really what our Constitution is about, it is appropriate to give the legislature carte blanche to, say, make decisions about how it itself will, you know, allocate power, how its district lines will be drawn, and so on. So in some ways, I think these are linked. If you care about accountability, and that's one reason why you're skeptical of excessive delegations, it's also a reason why you might worry about things like gerrymandering. Think that maybe the Constitution might have something to say about that, if it's really a document that ultimately is a document that rests on popular sovereignty and the idea that we should all be consenting to the people who govern us.
Well, I think that's going to be the last word. We're a little bit over time, but we have some great questions, some great panels. Let's give them a round of applause.